It really is quite something to see you all again. When we left, we had no idea what we were in for. Well, I should say we did and we didn't have any idea what we were in for. And neither did you. Since last we were with you, we have lost Dick and Senga, dear, sweet, sweet people, whom I miss already. So life continues on. Changes are with us always, whether we ask for them or not. And so this morning, as I gather with you to share some words, I'm mindful of so many things. And I was looking for some sort of reading that could hold all of this that we have been through together and separately in these last few months. And I found a poem by Stanley Kunitz, who was an American poet but of Jewish and Russian and Lithuanian descent, who died at the age of 100 in 2006. He was one of the favorite poets of a dear member of my congregation in D.C. who passed away just about a year before I left. Stanley Kunitz's poem entitled, "The Layers." I have walked through many lives, some of them my own, and I am not who I was. Though some principle of being abides, from which I struggle not to stray. When I look behind, as I am compelled to look before I can gather strength to proceed on my journey, I see the milestones dwindling toward the horizon and the slow fires trailing from the abandoned campsites over which scavenger angels wheel on heavy wings. Oh, I have made myself a tribe out of my true affections, and my tribe is scattered. How shall the heart be reconciled to its feast of losses? In a rising wind, the manic dust of my friends, those who fell along the way, bitterly stings my face. Yet I turn, exulting somewhat with my will intact to go wherever I need to go. And every stone on the road is precious to me. In my darkest night, when the moon was covered and I roamed through wreckage, a nimbus clouded voice directed me, "Live in the layers, not on the litter." Though I lack the art to decipher it, no doubt the next chapter in my book of transformations is already written. I am not done with my changes. There are many things that I appreciate about this time of year, about the autumn, but at the top of that list is the fact that I feel like this season is the season of life assessment. All the major holidays of this season, especially the Jewish ones of Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah, those holidays of atonement and the new year of life, as well as Thanksgiving and the Day of All Souls and Remembrance Day, even the fun, playful one of Halloween, all point to matters of looking at one's life, giving thanks and saying thank you. With all of this, we are pushed at least that once a year, this time of year, to reflect on generosity. We think about all that we have received in life, about the blessings and the gifts. And we acknowledge, perhaps most especially, the generosity that we have been on the receiving end of, that we did not earn. Kindnesses shown to us and occasions of joy that we didn't create or make ourselves, but were simply handed to us. We give thanks for all that we have been given simply by virtue of being alive here and now. This is what the poet's words remind me of. All the layers of living, those who have gone before us and those who are following after, the layers of life continue on their march. One of the observations of ministry that I have made again and again is that we human beings seem to crave a certain kind of alignment. Call it a chiropractic of the soul, if you will. We want our heads and our hearts and our hands to be in agreement as often as possible. In other words, we want what we think or what we believe to be true about life to fit well with how we feel about being alive. And then we want to express those values and priorities through our hands, through what we do in the world. The spiritual lesson that ministry has offered me over and over again is that while we seek this head, heart, hand alignment, we rarely feel that we have sufficiently found it. In fact, many people feel bereft and upset that there is so little alignment in their lives, that they are not where they want to be or who they wish to be. Many of us fear that we have not arrived at a place of wholeness. And this morning, I want to focus on two-thirds of that head, heart and hand alignment. I'm going to focus on the heart and the hands. How does what I feel to be important and meaningful get expressed in how I live? How do my choices reflect my heartfelt values? And how does our support of this church community fit in that equation? Many years ago, I had the good fortune of being a part of a lecture series that Parker Palmer, Quaker educator, gave. And he spoke very movingly about this disconnect, about our longing for wholeness and the fact that we so often feel we have fallen short. One of the things he said is that we feel like we have roles that we fulfill in our lives. Professional roles, personal roles, and that who we feel ourselves to be and who we are in those roles often is not in alignment. Who I feel my inner self to be and who I am in the world is not one and the same, he said. And the larger the distance between who I feel myself to be and who I am in the world, the greater my sense of sadness, the greater my sense of lostness. He said, think about it. When you spend time with children, soul and role are one and the same. A two-year-old cannot pretend to be something they're not, and they won't try. They will tell you right up front how they're feeling, what they're thinking. In fact, I've known a few that they can't have a thought without it coming out of their mouths. He says, but as we grow older, what happens? We learn that it's not safe. That it's not safe to have our soul and role, who we are, so close to the skin. We've been taught again and again. We've been hurt over and over, so we retreat. We show a little less and a little less and still a little less of who we really are. We put up our armor. We walk out into the world a little more tightly wound. He said, somehow we have to break down that wall again. Not that we're going to return to being toddlers, nor should we want to, but that we need to have soul and role together. We need to feel that we can be who we are in the world without fear. You may have noticed that when I was thinking about this generosity season, one of the things I thought about and wrote about in your Canvas brochure was about choices. Because a lot of interesting things and studies have been going on recently, sociologists and psychologists studying how we human beings deal with all these choices we have. You would think that because we have so many options, we would be happier. You walk in the grocery store, you have at least 20 choices just of mustard that you could have. Surely one of those mustards is just perfect for you. And yet, just because we have all these choices, all these ways in which we could find contentment and happiness, all of these choices that we can make haven't made us better choosers. Apparently, having more options isn't enough. You have to have a discerning heart. You have to be able to align soul and role, hand and heart, and say, what is most important to me? Just because there are all these choices doesn't mean that I will make the best one. Especially not if I'm not willing to look within and really ask myself, is it important? Does it matter? Is it valuable? We need to make choices in life, to set priorities in life that we feel good about. We need to prioritize regularly and recalibrate when necessary. If we can't give equally of our time and our energy and our resources at all times, and Lord knows we can't, then we will have to decide what comes first. You can do all the internet research you want about what's the best choice, and then sooner or later you will have to ask your heart, ask your spirit, ask your soul. For those of you who are more of the humanist mindset, you'll have to ask your conscience if the answer presenting itself seems right to you. Is this choice that I am about to make one that I can live with, quite literally? Is it one that I won't later regret? Now, I arrived this morning, I was working on all this writing about the heart, and I realized that this heart metaphor has new meaning for me. That little baby who was making too much noise that he had to leave the room had some issues of the heart. And so I realize now that even though we talk about our hearts in a way that is just a figure of speech, just about this organ that we have at the center of our body, I know more keenly now that it is what keeps the pulse of life. That sometimes, friends, we have to get to the heart of the matter indeed. Will we feel good about how much heart we have given to our lives? Or will we feel that we have been stingy? Will we, when our own heart stops beating, whenever that is, feel that we have listened to its urgent and incessant counsel? You know, Demetrius, with his little insistent heart, as you know, has a name from my grandfather. My maternal grandfather, Edgar Allan Green, Demetrius's second middle name is Green in honor of the grandfather, the great-grandfather, whose birthday he shares. My maternal grandfather was born on August 7th, 1912. Demetrius was born on August 7th, 2012. And I think of my grandfather as I speak with you this morning because he was for me a model of generosity. My grandfather left what I consider a legacy of generosity, a life that was lived in simplicity and in giving. My grandfather grew up in small town Western Maryland, lived almost his entire life in that one place. He died at the age of 90, nearly a decade ago now, and he never met either of his great-grandchildren. And yet so much of what he left behind is a gift to them. Last night, I dug into a little chest that my mother bequeathed to me, full of children's books of my grandfather's. One with his 9-year-old scrawl on the inside cover of a book published in 1935. My grandfather used to sit in the balcony, usher at his own small-town Methodist church, and as I wiggled next to him, trying to sit still during the church service, he would draw little mice and birds on the order of service to keep me interested. He would sing along to the old hymns like the one that Braden played, Just a Closer Walk with Thee, Old Rugged Cross, all of these standard from the garden. He knew all of these hymns, and yet he didn't wear his devoutness on his sleeve, but it was a huge part of who he was. My grandfather used to play catch with me, tomboy that I was, playing football catch in the yard of his home. When I would drop the ball, he would say, Nice catch, if you would have had it. And when I think of him now, when I think of all that he left behind when he died, he left behind money to the homeless shelter in his community, money to his church family, and money so that his great-grandchildren might know a better education and a better life. It brings tears to my eyes every time I think that he did so much for so many people he would never know. And so today I want to invite you to think about how you want to leave your legacy, about what you might want to do for this community, about what you are willing to give to this community that touches our hearts and inspires the work of our hands. How might you align your heart and your hands when it comes to First Unitarian Church? There is so much that we can do and be together in this place, especially with the supportive resources to make some of the dreams that we have possible. I could list off many, many things that we could do, redesigning our website, adding to our music program, adding to our children and youth program. But you know what all of the dreams are. I would just be listing my favorite few. Really, it comes down to our hearts. We have, I believe, not yet reached our potential as a community, not by a long shot. And to do and be all that we might wish and dream and hope will take all that our hearts can muster. We'll take all of the resources that we can spare. So I want to invite you to reflect this week, since you will return next Sunday with your pledges, about what this congregation means to you and about your dreams for it. I, for one, will be thinking about Edgar Allan Green, whose tombstone is behind that little church that he loved so dearly. The church that I now love so dearly, though I'm not a Methodist and 3,000 miles away, because some essence of him is there, some essence of my grandmother as well. We beget generosity in those who follow after us if we show them by our example that it is better to live life like this than like this. Generosity, my friends, is not about an amount. It's about a feeling. A feeling that says, I have given what I can, given something that I feel good about to a place and a people that matter a great deal to me. Generosity involves a type of giving that leaves us with a smile on our face. The knowledge that my giving matters. So I invite you this week to think about giving generously, giving to a future congregation that you can't yet see, a future community that you don't yet know firsthand. For that's what my grandfather did. He knew that the giving felt right. He knew that it was who he was. And he left his life knowing that he had left behind a legacy he believed in. And I pray that I will be able to do the same. In fact, I pray that we all will. So may it be, and amen.